Our speaker for this session on, our main speaker for this session on the environment, a moral issue for the saints, and that's just a general topic, and that's going to be exactly what's going to be discussed. We'll leave that to the speakers. The idea of this session started last year when I had brought my friend from Australia, Rick Saar, to Sunstone to speak on gun control. He's an international expert on gun control, and he just did a marvelous job, in my opinion. But we should do more. What?
Closer
to the mic. Okay. Is that good? Okay. Right. Just pick it up. Well, it's only a certain length. You can't. So is that working now? There's this too on the radio station. So anyway, and so we thought of Christian Anderson right away was conceived as an excellent person to talk about the environment. It's a very significant issue in our society, in our world today. And it's a delight to introduce Christian, because I have followed him since he was like a toddler, because I stayed at the Anderson's house many, many, many times over the years. So I saw him grow from a little squirt up to a much, much bigger squirt. And one thing I really noticed, which I tied to his current interest, is that I was interested in how often Paul, his father, would talk to little Christian about some scientific thing that could be observed in the environment around the house or outside the house or whatever. And I thought, he's really teaching his boy. And it's not surprising to me then that Christian ended up as a scientist. A Christian grew up in the church, and he's married to Marina, and they also have six rabbits in the family, and they're very important. And he's a lifelong member of the church, served on a mission. He spent every summer isolated with Levina Fielding Anderson, that's somebody that he knows, I guess, in a privately owned canyon, raising an abandoned fawn, chipmunks, grand squirrels, hummingbirds, and various other items. He focused on ecology at Stanford, to spend a semester at sea on a ship. Won both a two-year and a three-year North National Science Fellowship to study conservative biology. My political background. My political background. Really, that we didn't have it there. At Scripps Institute, and he studied with exceptionally prominent climate scientists like Naomi Oreskes, Roger Revelle, Ralph Keeling, and VR, whatever his last name is. And he studied mathematical genetics and wrote successful software. And he did a postdoctorate fellowship at Harvard University on conservation genetics, and Ernst May's office at the I'm going to blame his handwriting. It's not my. If you typed, I can read it. And he continues to publish research on genetics of marine species. Okay, and then giving a comment afterward is Bob Reese, who everybody knows. Bob. He's a founder of Dialogue, a longtime frequent and commentator at Sunstone, widely published, career in teaching literature at UCLA, and now is a professor of Mormon studies at the Graduate Union, Theological Union in Berkeley, so very distinguished commentator. I don't know exactly how I'm going to handle this. There's this radio mic here, and I've handled it with my hand, so I don't know what's the best way if it's going to work. I think it's probably National Public Radio.
Okay.
I'm going to turn this way so grab your voice.
All right.
Also.
Mm-hmm. Making up my conclusions here. You would never know how it all ends.
I thought I'd try to put the conclusion at the end. This is the first time I've seen holy water. a sunstone. So I'm
right.
I'm not going too well.
Okay. You're saved. Congratulations. Yes. Sounds good. All right, so we have a somewhat misleading title here. This is not primarily about the environment per se. This is mostly about skepticism and why Mormons are particularly susceptible to the sorts of attacks that scientific skeptics bring forward. Generally speaking, cynical and attacks that seem to be that have changed the way people talk about science and the way that people talk about things that have been generally accepted by scientists even. These are the sorts of attacks that Mormons seem to be particularly susceptible to in terms of polling numbers, and there are some reasons for that, and I'm going to talk about what those are and why those, what we can do about them a little bit. So, get ready. It's going to be fun. So, this is mostly a talk about how to talk about scientists. Global warming is an excellent example of this, so people who are here for global warming are not going to miss out. It shows really good examples of how communication can be distorted or misleading, even though there are serious consequences for the entire human race, and how people can hold mistaken beliefs very strongly, even in the face of overwhelming evidence. So as you heard from Bill, I've spent now over half my life studying Earth's environment and ecosystems at some, you know, big important schools surrounded by very big important scientists and equally committed and generally intelligent students, and over that time I've seen a lot of us go a little mad-eyed from stating the obvious. This is a poem by Richard Wilbur who talks about advice to a prophet. He says, "As you come, and soon you must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity. Don't give us numbers, give us something we can believe in, the effects that will change." This is something scientists are generally very bad at doing. We're trained to give bad talks. So I'm going to give you a very brief example of how scientists would talk about global warming. I've heard lots of these talks over the time, and I've had lots of practice giving these sorts of talks. So a typical one-minute presentation might go something like this. So to measure carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, scientists have used infrared absorption spectrometry. We have this very nice diagram of the infrared absorption spectrum of carbon dioxide there. They set it up at 3,400 meters in elevation. Using the absorption spectrum, you can calculate how much carbon dioxide is in the air using mole fractionation, the combined gas law, that's PV equals NRT, where N is Avogadro's number. And to make sure you're getting accurate results, you calibrate the voltage every month using methodology and Keeling in 1957. To analyze the data, we approximate a derivative to the time series by first differencing. That makes the assumption that the derivative of carbon concentrations with respect to time is approximately equal to the change in carbon over the change in time. We then use linear regression to test the hypothesis that for the formula delta C over delta T equals alpha plus beta T, it's the case that beta is greater than zero, with the significance of P equals 0.5. So here are our results. As you can clearly see, we were very significant. This isn't funny, it really is significant. Okay, so in conclusion, the beta coefficient of the linear model was significantly greater than zero. This implies, crucially, that a simple linear model of carbon concentration is insufficient to describe the data and suggests that a second order term may be necessary. However, we cannot be sure that a nonlinear equation would not be more appropriate. All right, so how do you feel? Are you all jazzed up to go save the environment now? Out of curiosity, did anyone get anything out of that? I mean, because really this is what we would say at an academic conference, maybe a little. So what was the point of that?
So what I got was that, so number two, conclusion, that the amount of influence in the environment of increase in carbon is greater than simply the increase in the amount of carbon.
Pretty much, right. That the amount of carbon in the atmosphere is not only increasing, but it's accelerating.
Right.
So it's not just a linear increase, but you need it's times squared. Right. So it's not even clear what I said, you know, let alone what it means, why it would matter to anyone, why anyone would care about it. But these are the sorts of talks you kind of have to give if you're going to be an academic scientist. You have to be very careful about what you're saying. You have to be very clear on your methodology, and you have to state very clearly the limitations of your method. I did a lot of things right in this talk, despite it being terrible. Yes?
Christopher, you did one thing very wrong.
Yes.
You used transmittance. It's the absorbance that's linear in concentration, assuming Beer's law.
Exactly. You see? Even there, we have corrections. So that this was not dull enough. It was concerning.
I do spectroscopy. I'm a scientist.
There we go. Thank you, Alan Eastman. Okay, so let me give you an example of a different way of saying exactly the same thing. So ever since I was little, I've been fascinated by marine biology. There's a picture of me reading about sharks from a book that's larger than I am. Oh dear. We lost all my beautiful animation. So there are more pictures of me being more interested in oceans and swimming with dolphins and being with the biggest smile, goofy grin you can imagine on my face about these things. When I finally made it to graduate school and I was able to study marine organisms full time, I started volunteering at Birch Aquarium. Goodness, just all the animation is broken. Where I learned even more, I got not only could read about marine organisms, but I got to see them firsthand. This is an example of a pom-pom crab, just this amazingly fascinating organism that lives on the reefs of the Philippines. And instead of having claws, they have anemones that they attach to their hands and use the anemones to catch food. And when they molt, even though you cannot remove the anemones yourself without killing the anemones and the crab, when they molt, they're able to tell the anemone somehow chemically that it's time to let go and transfer the anemone onto their new carapace as it's growing. Amazing stuff. I had four more examples on this broken PowerPoint. These are just four examples of organisms that live on coral reefs. Reefs are so diverse, we have no idea even the order of magnitude of animals there are. There are somewhere between 1 million and 10 million different species that live there. If every species got one half of one sheet of paper, it would make a book that's 3,000 feet long, 3,000 feet tall. And corals themselves are organisms. They make these amazing structures that are the size of continents. There are some that run all the length of Central America. There's another one that runs the entire length of Australia. And they're these little tiny jellyfish that instead of swimming away, they turn upside down and grow calcium around themselves, grow these hard shells and stick their tentacles up in the air. And instead of catching things, they capture algae that grows inside of their tentacles and photosynthesizes food for them. It's like being so eco-friendly that you actually grow your own food inside your skin. It's incredible stuff. But while I was there, goodness, am I going to get one of the keys? All right. Also, the mouse is broken on this laptop. Okay. But one of the exhibits that didn't show animals at Scripps showed instead this graph on the left. This is called the Keeling Curve. It's named for Ralph Keeling, who was one of my professors at SIO. And looking at that, I realized I had a problem, which was that carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere are going up. And not only are they going up, but they are accelerating. They're going faster now than they ever have before. And the problem with that, for me, for studying the most cool, diverse, brilliant ecosystems that God has ever made, is that corals are surrounded by calcium carbonate, and carbonates do not do well in the presence of acid. When carbon dioxide levels go up in the atmosphere, some of that carbon goes into the water and makes carbonic acid, the same stuff that gives you bubbles in your soda. Now, not everyone knows what happens when carbonates and acids get together, but we do have commercial products that do that, that unite carbonates and acid in the form of Alka-Seltzer. That's what the holy water is. So, as carbon dioxide levels go up, this is what happens to Australia, for those of you on the audio. The structures, the size of continents go up in bubbles. We lose 10 million species. All right, so that seems like a better way of talking about the problems. It's not the way scientists generally do unless they're talking deliberately in a different theme, to a different audience. And so that means scientists constantly leave themselves open to attacks by people who aren't willing to play by scientific rules. Now, this was supposed to be a huge surprise to everyone. I had fancy animations, but remembering this Keeling curve here, there was someone who said, this generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. The US president said that. Most people would expect that to have happened maybe at the very earliest in the 1990s, right? But that was already clear in 1965. If any of you saw Selma, that this speech by Lyndon Johnson was given within weeks of the final speech of that movie. And if you think race relationships have improved slowly, just imagine what acceptance of climate science has happened in America. Here's a graph demonstrating how well climate science has been accepted. Less than half of the US population think humans are responsible for global warming. Of conservative religious people, according to the Pew Forum, people who disagree with the argument that humans cause global warming outnumber those who agree by a factor of 2-1. Yes, Kim?
So this graph is not just saying that half of the people don't accept human-caused global warming. This is global warming at all.
The gray bars are people who accept global warming but think that it's caused by sunspots or something besides people. So, and then there's no, and there's some who don't know. Yeah, so this is very discouraging. I mean, consensus has been around for a very long time. Nobody knows. Nobody agrees. So why is that? Why have skeptics had so much power? The answer turns out to be that it's a very small number of very powerful scientists that have been able to do this. In fact, pretty much it's two people named Fred. Here they are, Fred Seitz and Fred Singer. These guys were both part physicists on the Manhattan Project. Neither of them knows anything about the environment or has any professional training in environmental issues or in climatology, generally. They both, after the Manhattan Project, many scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project still are involved in science at UCSD. For some reason, they all migrated to the naval installations around San Diego and still work there. And all of them that I've talked to talk about how important it was to find some reason to give meaning to their work on the atom bomb. Most of them chose to do that through pacifism. These people chose to do it through a sort of extreme loyalty to America, which also translates into an extreme loyalty to capitalism and free market policies and Milton Friedman economic systems. And so anything that violates the ideas of free market, like climate problems, which just markets values don't capture, right? Things that should be priceless, things like clean air and the ability to walk outside without getting cancer and an environment that has biodiversity in it that supports us. These things should be priceless, but because they aren't market commodities, they end up being valueless. And this really disturbs people who are really committed to this sort of worldview, and they have fought against it for a very long time. They started out in the tobacco industry, to let you know the sort of the high moral value they're involved. Seitz was he had become the president of the AAAS, largely in gratitude. Eisenhower appointed him after he retired as president of the Manhattan Project. He was ousted by scientists that were disturbed by his aggressive policies. He used his position as the most important scientist in America to aggressively promote wartime policies in Vietnam and Korea, and was sort of ousted by people who thought that was not appropriate for scientists to be doing. He'd started working for the tobacco industry as a consultant in 1952 and started working full-time there in 1958. He did used a very common technique at the time. It's becoming less common now, which is to demand that the media be balanced in its approach, that even though he was almost the only scientist in the world who was arguing that tobacco had no health consequences, he demanded to be on every show where they had a scientist who said tobacco does have health consequences. And for decades, they went along with it. Remember, in my presentation, the very last thing I said was, we can't be sure a nonlinear model wouldn't be better. But it doesn't matter, right? Clearly, the trend is accelerating. He uses those statements. He went through all the research on this and found the statements where people discuss, frankly, the limitations of their studies and say, see, nobody knows. This study proved nothing because it had this problem in it. He was so good at this that the tobacco industry between 1954 and 1979 was sued 154 times by people who had cancer, and they won every lawsuit. There was not a single successful lawsuit in the first, 25 years of anti-cancer stuff. This was, he was indicted of criminal fraud, knowingly misleading people about the science behind tobacco in 2004, at which point it was too late. He was already in the hospital with a fatal disease and died a few months later. In the meantime, he became so livid at conferences where people were discussing these things that the tobacco industry started to view him as a liability. He was not just their hired gun to put people down. He was seen as dangerous and unreliable. So Seitz and Singer left the tobacco industry. He more or less got fired, and instead he joined Team B, which is was Reagan's task force on the Strategic Defense Initiative, on Star Wars. He was particularly useful in arguing against nuclear winter. Many of you remember Carl Sagan's documentary about nuclear winter. You might not know that was not shown on any broadcast television network until 5 years after it was made because of lawsuits that both Seitz and Singer brought against Sagan, saying that they were deliberately misrepresenting the science behind nuclear winter. Totally false, totally bogus, but it was still useful. It was so good that several conservative think tanks got their money together and hired them to hire the George C. Marshall Institute, which is still around, and causing people like me headaches. They weren't done. They did a similar attack on acid rain. They drafted, they pulled in Bill Nirenberg, who was also a president of the AAAS. He was also the president of Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Several of the classes I took about global warming and about the history of science in America happened in Nirenberg Auditorium down there. He was So acid rain had been demonstrated as causing tangible environmental harms by a scientist named Likens, who's still one of the most widely respected scientists in the world. It had been pretty much accepted by everyone by 1979. There were action plans, action groups formed under the Carter administration. He got voted out, Reagan got put in. Both the NSA and the EPA had reviewed them, had approved action plans, had accepted all the science, everything was going forward. Reagan instead insisted on a third panel under Nirenberg. This consisted of 10 people, 8 scientists who all agreed there was a problem, and 2 economists who told them to do nothing. Singer was one of these economists, even though he was a physicist by training and has no economic expertise. He insisted on writing a cost-benefit analysis as an appendix to the paper after it had been submitted, and instead of writing a cost-benefit analysis, wrote an attack on all of the other panelists, saying they were deliberately trying to silence him and that there was no evidence that acid rain was a problem, and it violated fundamental economic principles like harms that happen in one country cannot be expressed in the economy of another country, you know, which is, of course, absurd. Acid rain doesn't recognize national boundaries. Eventually, there was, under the first Bush, there was a panel put together to address acid rain problems. The panel that has mostly dealt with the issue cost about $10 billion in installing scrubbers and various other things, and has prevented $120 billion of harm. So it was a 12-to-1 cost-benefit ratio. In direct contrast to everything Seitz and Singer have been saying about it for the last 30 years. All right, ozone, same thing happens, you get the point. In 1981, the evidence was so strong that even DuPont, the primary producer of CFCs, agreed that they would cut down on their production to below minimum levels. They were big supporters of the Montreal Protocol. Everything seemed to be going great. 3 years after the Montreal Protocol, Singer came on board. He started the Heritage Foundation and continued to persecute ozone scientists even after they won the Nobel Prize. Secondhand Smoke, he does the same thing. He wrote this wonderful book, if you ever see it. It's called Junk Science at the EPA. It's full of quotes taken out of context that are not attributed to people. He's admitted that 5 or 6 of the most damning quotes about how scientists are making up all the health consequences of secondhand smoke were actually his wife, who has no training in science at all. She just said, all these scientists, they're doing terrible things, and so he did that. And he did another thing, which is something that several scientists have done since then in the global warming tactics, which is he founded his own conference, invited only people that he knew would say things favorable to his cause to it, published the proceedings in non-peer-reviewed journals, and then put them together in glitzy packages that he hands out at all media events to show that there is no scientific consensus on the issue. I'll include Rachel Carson just because I'm so mad. Rachel Carson is truly a heroine of environmentalism. She recognized problems of pesticide overuse in America decades before anyone else. She spent her life being persecuted for it. Seitz actually attacked her originally, said that she had, because she was a woman who had no children, she was obviously hormonally imbalanced, and therefore nothing you said could be used, could be taken seriously. She got DDT removed from America. It was replaced by safe chemicals that did not cause the deaths of billions upon billions of birds, leading to silent springs where no birds sing. She died in 2007, and immediately Seitz and Singer started a smear campaign against her. Well, not Seitz was dead by then, but Singer and Ningenberg started a smear campaign against her, talking about all the lies she had produced throughout her life. They've been so successful at this that 2 of the top 6 returns on Google, if you search for Rachel Carson, are The Lies of Rachel Carson and Rachel Carson's Deadly Fantasies, even though there was no criticism about her before her death. That she was widely regarded as... Okay, finally, we get to global warming. All right, so we had reached a consensus that global warming is real, it's a problem. Politicians are on board with this in 1970. In October of 1980, there was a EPA recommendation called the Changing Climate. It had reached the conclusion that carbon dioxide levels would double by 2065, that would result in an increase in temperatures of 1.5 to 4.5 degrees centigrade, or 3 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit. This is a little bit different scale than most people are used to, but think of that as a fever. If your temperature went up by 9 degrees Fahrenheit, this would be very bad for your internal system. The effects will be 2 to 3 times stronger over the poles, and we can expect a 70 centimeter sea rise this century and a 500 to 600 centimeter meter sea rise before it can be stopped. That will put Florida underwater. Will drastically change the circulation patterns of the Atlantic Ocean, changing weather patterns in Europe, other things like that. Nirenberg again was in charge of writing this document of doing the policy. There were lots of backdoor shenanigans. He hired two little-known economists to do the recommendations to the government based on the science. Both of them recommended that you do nothing. These scientists were not well-known. They were not well-respected in their field and remain pretty much unknown today. So Santer, a scientist named Benjamin Santer, was had latched onto a mathematical technique that very few people knew about at the time called fingerprinting. It's a very complicated form of statistical analysis that not many people knew about, but it was the first really strong evidence you had that it was not sunspots, it was not natural variation in Earth's climate, it really was carbon dioxide from people leading to climate change that was undeniable increases. Singer then partners with the current president of Scripps Institution of Oceanography named Roger Revelle to write a paper. This was years later after, I'm sorry, this was in, oh geez, when was this, 2000? This was when, right as Al Gore was running for president and was about to do his first debate. He had partnered with Roger Revelle, who was dying at the time. He went up to him at the last talk he gave publicly and asked if they could write a joint paper about the importance of climate change. Revelle had a heart attack on the plane ride home, and Singer wrote a paper which he sent to Revelle at the hospital. Revelle asked him not to publish it. Singer published it anyway with Revelle's name as the first author. In later publications, he didn't even identify himself as an author on the paper, so this was Revelle's paper, where, of course, what he claimed was that he, under the guise of writing as Revelle, was mistaken. Climate change is not a problem. He was mistaken when he told this to Al Gore. Al Gore is obviously deluded if he thinks climate change is a problem. This comes out right before the debates, discredits him. It's a major political embarrassment. Revelle's last grad student is Justin, at the time was named Justin Lancaster. Really nice guy, still teaches at UCSD. He brought this to the attention of the media, that this was obviously deceptive smear tactic. Singer's think tank, the Marshall Institute, pooled their money, spent more than $3 million in attorney's fees against a poor grad student, forced him to retract the statement, and successfully had him removed from academia for 4 years. He was not allowed to publish any articles in peer-reviewed journals for 4 years before he could start working. This continues. In the last election cycle, one of the Republican strategists named Luntz wrote a memo where he outlined the Republican strategy for talking about climate change. He says, always use the word climate change instead of global warming because, you know, climate changes, that could be good, that could be bad. Global warming is scary, don't ever use that word. Always use emotional appeals, as that is more important than truth. And as long as voters think there is a debate, you still have a window. Let me get the quote absolutely right here. As long, all right, the scientific debate is closing against us, but not yet closed. There is still a window of opportunity to challenge the science because voters believe there is no consensus about global warming within the scientific community. Should the public come to believe that scientific issues are settled, then their views about global warming will change accordingly. Therefore, you need to continue to make the lack of scientific certainty a primary issue in the debate. Under Bush 2, this kind of hits ahead when Christine Whitman, who was the head of the EPA, thought everyone was on board with the Kyoto Protocol, went there to sign for the United States, was told at the last second to back out. She came home for an explanation and was ordered by Cheney to relax all EPA standards on both arsenic in the water and the amount of acceptable pollutants in coal-fired plant. That's right. She refused. She was fired. She was forced to say that she resigned to be with her family. They later fired the chief economist for similar reasons, but he was very independently wealthy and wrote a book about all the backdoor shenanigans going on, and she said this was true as soon as Bush was out of office. Okay, so that brings the question, why do people do these things, and why do we fall for it? So I think there are five reasons. There's science journalism, and we'll go through the five. So I don't want to give the impression that these skeptics, these people who talk about that, are inherently evil people and we are inherently good people, because it's certainly more nuanced than that. All right. How are we doing on time?
Oh, we have 20 minutes left in the session.
Okay.
Bob said he's not going to talk more than 10 minutes or less.
Okay.
But that still only needs about 10 minutes for
all right. Well, hurry. So science, as I said earlier, science journalism is based on this ethic of balance, which produces bias when there really aren't two sides to an issue. Some issues only have one side, some issues have five sides. Fact-checking is amazingly poor these days. Just this, in the last 2 months, you may remember there was an article about a new study reveals that eating chocolate will lower your body mass index. That was done by a guy named Jonathan Bohannon for a documentary. He made up a scientist, he made up a journal that this study was published in, and he made up an institute that he worked for. No, this was on the front page of every major journal in Europe, and most of the ones in America too, before he outed himself. He wasn't even caught. You know, this had been going on for weeks before he said, okay, this was a joke, I was trying to make a point. There's also a need for sensation, when was this, Monday, the Telegraph had this article that says, Earth is heading for a mini ice age in the next 15 years. A more accurate article would be, one Russian scientist produced a model that is slightly less accurate than other models of sunspots that says there may be conditions that were like conditions 15,000 years ago on the sun, even though no reputable scientist anyway, is arguing that the sun is the primary driver of global warming. And then there's the draw of fame, right? That one Russian scientist, by saying something a little bit controversial, gets on the front page of the Telegraph. You know, no matter how good her science was, if she had been the 98th person to say, yeah, global warming is still happening, would not have been on the front page of anything. All right. We also have a persecution complex, right? Scientists are an easy group to hate, like Sheldon Cooper, right? That's sort of the popular image you have, that they're self-important, they're interested in unpopular things, and they give you the uneasy feeling that they are smarter than you, at least in the limited field where they are in. Mormons generally believe that the world is out to get us, and especially those wicked intellectuals who just want to teach your children to be Democrats and scoff at the things of God. And so they're particularly prone to this sort of ideology that the, you know, scientists just need to be taken down a peg. Any way you can do it. There's also hero worship, right? We have these heroic images of Joseph Smith, an outsider who knew the truth and who founded the one true church and who was persecuted for fighting against false traditions. We love to talk about Albert Einstein, who's this brilliant outsider who comes in and changes all the paradigms of science, and we forget he's almost the only person who ever did that, right? That there are very few examples of real paradigm shifts ever happening, and he's almost the only one who was a total outsider to the scientific community who did it. I've talked a little bit about free markets already. LDS, of course, had a big swing towards conservatism politically and economically in the 1960s and 70s. You can read great books about that available outside. Proceeds go to Sunstone. And so as a result, both Mormons and several free market-based scientists sort of conflate the global economic crisis with communism. There are actually, if you go online right now, you can find many books that talk about the red roots of the green movement. That a little bit silly. And therefore, the environmental crisis, the people who talk about the environmental crisis are the enemy. All right, and then finally, there's the scientific method. And scientists really shoot themselves in the foot on this, I think. We teach all school children that you should trust science because it has this perfect method that will never fail, which is you have a hypothesis, you test it with an experiment, and then you have a theory that grows out of that, or you discard it and you come to a new hypothesis. The problem with that is that it is wrong. That's almost never the way science happens. You should trust. So what should we do instead? Mormons sort of believe in deferring to authorities because they have access to more knowledge. That's sort of the way science works, is that we have peer review. All science is institutionalized skepticism, is the phrase Naomi Oreskes uses. The burden of proof for a new idea rests on the scientist who's bringing that, and it's very difficult to get a new idea accepted by the statement. It's not a jury of your peers that's reviewing it, it's a jury of the uber geeks, the most critical people possible, and the ones who are most deeply invested in the old way of doing things. So it's hard to get consensus. Having a consensus on anything, Alan can tell, is really hard in the scientific community. The fact that we have a consensus on global warming is kind of incredible, because scientists make a career out of fighting over things that no one would really... it's not reasonable to fight over. It's important, therefore, that we spend a lot of our time seeking out scientific consensus instead of clicking on those articles that say, you won't believe what this Nobel Prize physicist said about global warming. It would be useful to frame the environmental crisis as service opportunities. Global warming affects hot, dry, and flat countries. It can trigger disease, outbreaks, famine, superstorms. Our actions, good and bad, really do have global consequences. And, you know, it's based on gospel principles. My favorite scripture, pleaseth God that he hath given all these things unto man for unto this end, where they need to be used, with judgment, not to excess, neither by extortion. And finally, it's important to not be such a scientist, to don't just talk to other scientists about these issues, but go out and talk to people who are skeptical about these things, and I'm going to take my own advice and stop talking now. So, thank you.
Thank you.
That was impressive. It makes me think that it would really be wonderful to have a modern version of Dante's Inferno, into which we could place some of these people in that middle circle, which is just people floating around in ice. I think Christian's made a very good argument for the fact that addressing global warming is the moral imperative of not only our generation, but of our children's and our grandchildren's generation. I was fortunate enough to attend a huge conference at Graduate Theological Union about 6 weeks ago. 1,500 people from around the world, some of the top climate scientists as well as moral thinkers, in a seminar called Seizing the Alternative Toward an Ecological Alternative. And there were religious leaders from around the world, each of whom had a three-day track to talk about what their religion could bring as a perspective on this issue. And there was a Latter-day Saint track that I thought was really very interesting, because it included some very thoughtful ideas. My own presentation was called Earth Stewardship in Light of the Gospel of St. Matthew and King Benjamin's Address. And what I tried to do was look at both the New Testament and the Book of Mormon in terms of what it instructs us as Latter-day Saints about how to address this problem. In the 25th chapter of Matthew, the Gospel, or Jesus gives the ultimate challenge to his followers. They are always to consider those whom they consider the least as if they were Jesus himself. And Jesus speaks about this challenge to his disciples in the New Testament in the past tense. I was in prison, you didn't, etc. But I think he clearly intends for us in that that last great teaching, and it's really interesting, you come to the 25th chapter of Matthew, Jesus stops using parables and tries to speak really directly. And I think he intends that we think about it not simply in terms of the past, what we might have done to Jesus, but in terms of the present, and also by those who will be adversely affected in the future by our indifference and our inaction on this particular thing. In other words, he is saying that we should consider those who will suffer from disease, destruction, and death because we fail to act in the interest of future generations as far as the earth is concerned, as if they, those people we see in the future, were Jesus. Francisco Goldman says the great metaphor at the heart of the Gospel of St. Matthew is that those who suffer, and we would say those who will suffer, are joined through suffering and grace in Jesus Christ. Therefore, it seems to me that, and also confirmed by King Benjamin's address in the Book of Mormon, in which we are to think of others and to serve others, and without question as to their whether or not they brought it on themselves or whether or not they deserve it. So I think as we look at climate change and we look at these issues, these moral issues, I think what we should be thinking about is what we would say if our great-granddaughter were to say, "Why didn't you do something? I am here without any water." Or what we would say to a great-grandson who is standing someplace and the water is rising and he can't stop it. I was on the island nation of Kiribati in January. Kiribati is this large 32 island nation spread across an expanse of ocean as wide as the United States. I was there on behalf of the Liahona Children's Foundation, which, as some of you know, addresses malnutrition among Latter-day Saints and their friends in the developing world. The highest place on Kiribati is about a meter. Kiribati will be the first nation in the world to lose all of its land mass to rising seas. And it will happen in this century. 17% of the population of Kiribati is Latter-day Saint, but the water is rising for everybody, not just for them. And it is one of the poorest nations in the world, 60% unemployment, the highest rate of diabetes in the world. The scriptures tell us that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, but it's also ours. It is a great gift from God, one of the greatest gifts that He's given us. And we have a moral choice, as we always do, as to what we're going to do with that gift, as with all the gifts of God. Here's a question. What is the largest and the oldest living organism in the world?
It's an aspen grove in the heart of Utah.
It's an aspen grove in the heart of Utah. The Lord has a wonderful sense of irony. The largest and longest living organism in the world is down by Fish Lake. It's called Pando. It has survived for 70 or 80,000 years, and it's starting to die because of global warming. I would love to see a movement among Latter-day Saints to have that designated as a national monument. I know it's a state treasure, but it's also a national and an international treasure. And the group of people at this conference in Claremont, there's an organization now called Pando Populus who uses that as a symbol, as a metaphor for what's happening in the world and what we can do about it. We sing a hymn, "The Earth Was Once a Garden Place." It could be so again when Jesus comes. It's up to us. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. We have about 8 minutes left. Similar to Bob, I have two grandchildren that are 10 and 15 years old, and I think about what kind of environment they're going to have when they're 50, 60, 70, 80. They could even live till the end of the century. And so it's very, 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 very discouraging to think about. Questions, comments from the floor? We've got 8 minutes or so. Seven and a half now. Seven and a quarter. Yes.
Christian had to rush through.
Come on up to the Yeah, and anybody else wants to speak?
It's not a question, it's an invitation. Christian had to sort of rush through his recommendations of how we should talk. And if there are no other questions, I'd love to hear more on that.
Well, so briefly, I didn't primarily address the moral dimensions that Bob talked about so eloquently, primarily because I have tremendous faith in Mormons that once they know there is a problem and what to do about it, we are incredible at sort of deploying en masse to deal with it. I always get offended by General Conference, and I always get inspired by the little sections between conference about the good people do, even though they're hearing all this, you know, kind of offensive rhetoric some of the time. When you talk about these sorts of things, it's important to use evidence last, right? That in this book by Randy Olson, who was one of my teachers at Scripps, he talks about how effective arguments address you in four ways. They go to your head, they go to your heart, they go to your gut, and they go to your crotch, and you should do that in reverse order whenever possible. Tell a personal story, right? It was a lot better imagining me as a young scientist looking at a curve saying, you have no future career in coral reef ecology. They'll all be gone by the time, by the end of your career. Than it was me saying, you know, the beta coefficient is possible. And be sincere that you're talking from a place of caring about the person. You're not trying to win an argument with someone else, right? You're trying to help them be a good Christian, and they're confused about what that is because there are deceitful people out in the world. And I think the central metaphor, maybe for a church, the only scripture that occurs in all four standard works is. Anyone know? The earth shall burn as an oven. Well, actually, that one is leads up to the one which is the hearts of the children will turn to the fathers and the fathers to the children. We're excellent at genealogy, right? We're really good at half of that scripture. We are not good at the second half. We need a proclamation on the environment. It was horrible earlier this year when one of my best friends, Danny Richter, who was a student my year, was going to the Vatican and explaining climate problems to the Pope, who came out with a 135-page papal encyclical because he recognizes that global warming is going to hurt the 3 billion poorest people in the world disproportionately. At the same time, I was listening to a podcast where Rachel Maybe Whipple talked about how hard she was trying to get a proclamation on the environment and instead got a 2-minute PSA that says generally positive things that the LDS Church is in favor of there being a world.
Next question. Okay. Aaron, come up here to the mic. So you're beyond.
Good. I'm not so sure this is quite as much a question, but I'd add to Christian's list. Get some information. If you Google answers to questions about global warming, there are a number of good sources there. But don't click on the Marshall Institute. You won't get good answers. One of the things that you need to tell people is that no, the world is, the second coming will not necessarily be before the end of global warming. Forget that one. It's not caused by sunspots. Yes, God designed the Earth to respond to changes. And people have been looking at how fast the Earth is responding to raised carbon dioxide levels. It turns out that the last time CO2 atmospheric levels were this high was quite a long time ago, and it took the Earth 50,000 years to adjust to as much change in CO2 concentration as we have seen in the last 100 years. So, yes,
there were crocodiles on Greenland.
Yeah, there are crocodiles in Greenland. So the Earth can change due to the natural processes that God built into it, but not as fast as we're messing things up. It's important to know.
Next question. Got about 3 minutes left. Come on, Marina. I hope she's going to be nice to the speaker.
This is not really a question, it's just a comment. But one of the biggest challenges I see to Mormons addressing global climate change is the fact that one of the biggest drivers of climate change is population growth, and telling Mormons to stop having so many children is like sort of antithetical to, you know, a lot of core doctrines of the church. So, I mean, that's I don't know how we're going to deal with that one.
But you two can deal with it in your own way.
Dr. Rabbit's instead.
Brush first.
Okay, we got a couple more minutes.
I was going to add that one of the things about that scripture that was alluded to reinforces that idea of the fathers and mothers, turning our hearts forward to the children who are turning their hearts back to us while we have time. We have the time. They will be caught in the tyranny of time. And so if our hearts are not turned to them and turned to the Lord, it seems to me that we will have, as the kids say, a lot of explaining to do.
Okay, one last question or comment or sermon or whatever, as long as it's not very long. Yeah, come on up, come up to the mic.
I'm involved in the animal rights and vegan community.
Come on up to the mic, we need you on tape. We don't want you to be anonymous.
I want to be anonymous. So I'm involved with the vegan community, a lot of the animal rights community, and there's a lot of argument going around currently that one of the greatest contributors to global warming is animal agriculture. I'm just wondering your thoughts on that.
Yes. Yeah, not just global warming, but all sorts of environmental issues. It takes a ridiculous amount of water to get a kilogram of beef. In some instances, it can take up to 800 kilograms of water for 1 kilogram of beef, as opposed to vegetables. Eating more vegetables, eating a plant-based diet, not only solves all the health problems that Marina has to deal with as a doctor, but also solves a whole host of environmental problems as well. It is definitely one of the very positive tactics you could take, and you know, it's embedded in our scriptures, right? Meat is to be used sparingly. There will be deceptive people who tell you not to. It's worth noting that our dietary recommendations, the food pyramid, we're the only country in the world that says dairy is a food group. There's a reason for that. It's that more than half the people in the world cannot eat dairy, and so saying that they have to is kind of ridiculous.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Great session, very informative, and tremendous moral problems. Thank you.